I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Speaking at George Mason University in September, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced changes to an Obama administration policy on campus sexual assault.
Through intimidation and coercion, the failed system has clearly pushed schools to overreach. With the heavy hand of Washington tipping the balance of her scale, the sad reality is that Lady Justice is not blind on campuses today. This unraveling of justice is shameful. It's wholly un-American, and it is anathema to the system of self-governance to which our founders pledged their lives over 240 years ago. There must be a better way forward.
The Obama-era guidelines required colleges to use what is called a preponderance of evidence when determining whether a student is responsible for a sexual assault. Critics said this lowest standard of proof denied the due process rights of the accused. Others are now concerned this new directive will silence assault victims, making them reluctant to come forward. DeVos said she would institute new rules after a public comment period. Well, joining us by telephone is Jeannie Sook Gerson. She's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. And Jeannie Sook Gerson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Nina Chowdhury. She's director of education and senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Nina Chowdhury, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with you, Nina, and I'd like to make sure, Jeannie, you're in on this as well. And I don't want to spend too much time on the Obama administration policies, but I think we need to understand that in order to better understand what Betsy DeVos is talking about. To you, Nina, why did the Obama administration send this Dear Colleague letter to college and university campuses?
Well, they issued this Dear Colleague letter in 2011 because schools, in fact, were asking for more guidance on how to ensure that they were addressing sexual violence on their campuses. And the 2011 letter essentially just reminded schools of longstanding obligations that they had to promptly investigate any reports of sexual assault and to do so fairly for both sides. And really what that guidance did, one of the most important things it did, was remind schools that they had the very serious obligation to address harassment and violence and that the process needed to be fair and impartial.
Jeannie, let me get you in on the conversation. Some of the critics have said that this resulted in kangaroo courts, that there was the basic lack of fairness, as we heard from Betsy DeVos. How do you see the impact of what the Obama administration did?
I agree with how Nina has characterized the Dear Colleague letter of 2011, except for the part where the Obama administration did reach beyond what was already an existing law in dictating that the preponderance of the evidence be the standard. I think that there are, for the most part, what the Dear Colleague letter did was to reiterate existing obligations, but the part that became controversial and why people thought that it was not valid was where it said you must do X, Y, and Z, where previous law had not actually indicated that because it was not a law either passed by Congress or put through formal procedures that would make them binding. So I think the Dear Colleague letter actually did acknowledge that, and that some of the things that were not actually binding mm-hmm. were then later treated as binding by the department. So it was not so much a problem with the Dear Colleague letter itself. It was how the department decided to treat the Dear Colleague letter status as if it were legally binding when it was not.
This notion of preponderance of evidence, my understanding is, in sort of layman's term, is something happened more likely than not. It's the more likely than not standard. Nina, is that how you see the standard?
Yes, it is. And I want to just point out that, in fact, over 80% of schools have been using and were using the preponderance standard in their general disciplinary processes even before the 2011 guidance came out. And the reason the Department of Education said that this is a standard that schools should be using based on, you know, its own investigations and the fact that schools were already using it, they sort of said, okay, we're going to make this clear at this point, is because that is the standard that is used in civil cases, in civil rights cases. It's really the standard that sort of puts both students in any sort of complaint on equal footing. And it says to both of those students, we value your educations equally, and we think that you both are equally credible, and we're going to try to find out what happened in this situation. And so it is typically the standard that is used in these kinds of cases.
Jeannie, how do you interpret what DeVos said? And we just played a little clip of that.
How I interpret what she said in her speech and also what happened later is that we are being told as schools, I'm as a professor at a school that previously had the clear and convincing evidence standard and changed it after we were found in violation of Title IX by the department. I think what it is saying to schools is you can use preponderance, but you can also use clear and convincing. Either one at the moment is considered to be compliant with Title IX in the absence of binding guidance to the contrary. It may be that this process that DeVos is now beginning, which is to have a notice and comment period for formal regulation that will be forthcoming, that at the end of that, what we will have is a mandatory preponderance standard. That could happen. It could be that at the end of that, we learn that either clear and convincing or preponderance is acceptable. It could be that we are required then to go to a clear and convincing standard. I do not think the latter is a likely result, but that is, of course, possible in this process.
And just so our listeners, including myself, understand, for Jeannie, the clear and convincing evidence compared to the more probable evidence is that something probably highly likely happened. Is that what that means?
I think it's definitely higher standard than more likely than not. It's clear and convincing in that some people say it's about 75% or 75%. The evidence weighs 75% in favor of one side versus the other side. 80% could be 65%. It's not clear exactly what the number is, but it's certainly not anywhere near as high as the criminal standard that you have, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, which I don't think is really plausibly being considered as an acceptable standard for Title IX purposes.
Nina, we heard Betsy DeVos saying that what the Obama administration did was shameful. It's un-American. We have to find a better way moving forward. What do you say in response to that?
Well, Marty, we are very worried about this interim guidance that Secretary DeVos put out a couple weeks ago. It's been clear from the beginning that this Department of Education is more concerned, I think, about the rights of accused students. And of course, I should start by saying we are all interested in a fair process. And I myself have represented young women and their families for, 20 years now in sexual assault cases. And I have worked with survivors. And actually, I was in a meeting with Secretary DeVos and survivors before they decided to make these changes. And one of the things that really struck me was that survivors told Secretary DeVos that they wanted a fair process, not just for themselves, because survivors are often the victims of unfair processes on campuses as well, but for those that they had accused of sexual assault. So everybody has an interest in a fair process, and Title IX has always required that. But what has happened now is that this interim guidance has really tilted the scales in favor of accused students, and it threatens to sort of return us to the days when sexual violence was really still in the shadows, and it still is. I mean, only 12% of sexual assaults are reported at the college level. It's vastly underreported because students are scared to come forward. They're afraid that they're going to be blamed. We've seen the kind of harassment that they face once they do come forward. And so this new guidance really tilts the scales. It allows, for instance, accused students to appeal if they are unhappy with the findings of an investigation. So a survivor in that situation would have no recourse if she, disagreed with the outcome of an investigation. And it allows for direct cross-examination of a survivor by the person that she has said raped her. You know, if you can only imagine the kind of trauma that that could inflict on survivors. So this guidance, we think, is really going to cause damage and make it harder for survivors to come forward and get justice.
Let me quote something that Candace Jackson said. She's the top civil rights official in the Education Department. And I believe this was after a meeting in the summer. She said the accusations, 90% of them, fall into the category of, quote, we were both drunk and we broke up. And 6 months later, I found myself under a Title IX investigation because she just decided that our last sleeping together was not quite right. Jeannie Sook, let me give you a chance to respond to that. Is she the right spokesman for this issue?
I think those comments were, she called them flippant, but I just think they were wrong and ill-advised.
Does it undercut the case, though, coming from DeVos and the Education Department?
I definitely think that it harmed the cause. If the cause is to try to usher in an understanding that what the department is trying to do here is create a fair process that is sympathetic to victims and is concerned about fairness for all, I think that does undercut the case. And however, I think that we have an obligation to look at what's in front of us, which is namely the guidance that has been issued, mm-hmm. the temporary guidance a few weeks ago that Nina referred to. I don't read the guidance the way Nina does in saying that what it does is say accusers are now primary and the accused are primary and over accusers. And I don't think that that's what it does any more than I think the Dear Colleague letter, what it meant to do was to try to say that you're supposed to favor accusers over the accused. I think that what this document is trying to do is bring us to a state where it's getting us ready to participate in a process where there will be notice and comment taken, and then there will be a regulation issued that takes into account all the different interests. But what is really notable about the guidance that DeVos issued a few weeks ago is that if you read it, it reads in a way that is so out of keeping with how a lot of people are describing it. A lot of people are describing it as, oh, it tells survivors that they don't matter. This is a war on women. This is telling survivors they don't need to bother to come forward. I believe that that is wrong. It's wrong. I believe it's dangerous to imply that that is what this document does. I think that what it does is lay out the obligation of schools to have a fair, impartial, prompt process that respects the rights of accusers and the accused, and there may be things that Nina and I both disagree with in the document. I certainly have things that I disagree with, namely the one that Nina mentioned about the asymmetric appeals. I think both sides should have the opportunity to appeal, but I don't think that as a whole the document is telling survivors you don't matter and you don't need to come forward now because nobody will take you seriously. I think that is an unfair and wrong, irresponsible characterization.
And we have to take a short break. I'm sure, Nina, you want to respond to that. That is Jeannie Sook Gerson. She's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Also with us, Nina Chowdhury, Director of Education, Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. We're discussing the Department of Education's changes or proposed changes to how colleges handle sexual assault complaints. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org and WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me play another clip from Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's speech at George Mason University. This was September 7th, talking about changes to the Obama-era rules for colleges handling sexual misconduct complaints.
The truth is that the system established by the prior administration has failed too many students. Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved. That's why we must do better.
I'm curious from you, Nina, and I hear your support of what the Obama administration did, but that was in 2011. Do you think there's a need for some kind of fix or update or reform of that?
So I think where schools have not gotten it right, and I think there are cases certainly where they have not had fair processes for either survivors or accused students, they need help getting it right. So I do not think the policies needed changing. Again, the policies were merely a sort of restatement of longstanding law. But what needs to happen is that schools need help in implementing those policies. You know, I liken it to if you have a rule for your children or for a household or for anything, and people are having trouble following the rules, you don't change the rules, you help them follow them. So, and I just want to address something that Jeannie said earlier. You know, the new interim guidance, a couple points. First of all, Secretary DeVos has criticized tremendously the 2011 guidance, you know, by saying it was issued without notice and comment. And yet here we have an interim guidance, no sense of when there's going to be notice and comment or on what, you know, that is already changing, trying to change policies on campuses and in elementary and secondary schools, which I think, by the way, people often don't realize that Title IX applies at all levels of education. And we see, unfortunately, that about 1 in 5 young women at every level of education are subjected to sexual assault. So there's the process point, which I think is an important one. And they issued this interim guidance also before they even considered hundreds of thousands of comments during an open comment period from parents and students and alumni around the country and school officials who said, please don't take away the 2011 guidance, keep it in place. And I also think if you do read the interim guidance from September 22nd, you will see that by encouraging, by having provisions in there that allow schools to provide appeal rights only to accused students, by allowing mediation of sexual assault claims, which is something that the 2011 guidance and guidance before that, again, that had been on the books for decades, had said was inappropriate for sexual assault cases, that this guidance is really tilting the scales in favor of accused students in a way that is going to hurt survivors. The scales were already balanced by Title IX, and Title IX required a fair process. And again, some schools may not have been getting it right, but this new guidance is really going to be a problem. I mean, to suggest that students should sort of sit down and try to work out a sexual assault as though it's some sort of miscommunication, I think really shows that this Department of Education has not, first of all, spent enough time talking to survivors and listening to them and doesn't really understand this issue.
I have to say, as I was putting my questions together for the show, and I'll put this to you, Jeannie, why is it the responsibility of we're talking about colleges and university campuses largely, why is it their responsibility to deal with allegations of a sexual assault or rape? These are alleged crimes. Why don't people go to the police? Why isn't it the criminal justice system that's dealing this? Why are colleges and universities the responsible ones?
Well, I will point out, just inspired by your question, that that is not something that is right now on the table, that colleges and responsibilities, right. The colleges do not have the responsibility to do this. That's not being debated. It is accepted by, I think, all the sides of this debate that colleges do have this responsibility, that they must address sexual misconduct that happens on campus or among their students or among their, you know, students and employees. And so it's kind of a notable point, and I think it's important to acknowledge. When you ask why, it's
right.
Really because of the federal law, Title IX, that doesn't say anything about sexual assault or about schools addressing it, but mainly the way that the Department of Education has interpreted Title IX over the decades. So all the way back in the 1990s, we saw the Department of Education under a different president, a Republican president, basically saying the schools have to address sexual harassment and they have to have investigations and they have to make findings and deal with it appropriately. And I think that that has held. And to the extent that sexual violence is included in what is meant by sexual harassment, then sexual violence, including sexual assault and rape, are matters that schools have responsibilities to deal with. And so I don't, right now, first of all, that was binding law issued in 1998. I don't think that that has, right now, is up for grabs. The way that DeVos is talking, the way that all the department documents are worded, it is very clear that schools do have that responsibility. It is said explicitly and repeatedly and without any ambiguity.
And I guess that, and you touched on this earlier, Nina, whether there are the correctly trained investigators and counselors, whether it's professional people that are dealing with these very serious allegations.
So let me just step back for 1 second, Marty, and explain, in addition to what Jeannie said, that, you know, so Title IX was passed in 1972. It is an education civil rights law. And the reason that sexual harassment, which includes sexual assault, is covered under Title IX is because it's a form of discrimination that affects students' access to education. So the many young women that I've had the privilege of representing over my many years at the Law Center, you know, when they are sexually assaulted, they not only you know, suffer the trauma from that, but it affects their education. They are often harassed after an assault, you know, in school. They are scared to go to their classes, to be in the same dorms. And so Title IX's point is to help students stay in school, to have access to their education. And the reason also, I mean, we also need to recognize that schools are dealing with all kinds of disciplinary issues. It's not just sexual assault, right? If somebody comes and punches another student, that's a simple assault that schools deal with, or theft or academic dishonesty. So schools are set up to deal with disciplinary issues regularly, some of which may also be crimes. And also, of course, you know, there are lots of reasons people don't go to the police. So it's very important that survivors have the option. They can always report both to their school or their police, or the police. It's their choice. And, you know, both sometimes. But there are many reasons. Mm-hmm. Many students of color, many immigrant students, you know, you can imagine there are lots of reasons that people distrust the police. And it's an entirely separate process. So I just want to make that point. But, you know, also to your question of training, yes, it's very important, and there are, you know, in the guidance from 2011 and other previous guidance, the department has always recommended and schools that they have training. There are other laws that require it. It's important for schools to, you know, have Title IX coordinators. Every school is supposed to have one by law, and that person can help with that kind of training. And everybody in the school community needs to understand, you know, what is sexual assault, what is sexual harassment, how is my school going to address it. So that everything is very transparent and clear. And yes, it is important to have those processes be handled, you know, by people who understand this and who are trained.
And that answers an email from Fred. He says, I'm confused. Can't the victim seek justice outside the whole system? And what you're saying, Nina, is that the victim or the survivor can do both, or can and choose one over the other.
Absolutely.
Let me get Joanne from, looks like, Oxford, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to mention that I think it is really important to note that rape happens to men, too, especially on college campuses at fraternity hazings and athletic programs. Let's use Penn State, for example. So the guests keep continuously referring to women, and I just, as a rape survivor myself, I've met several male victims who feel even more shame than I do. So I just want to be open and honest and all-inclusive in the conversation.
Absolutely, Joanne. I appreciate the call. Let me give Jeannie and then Nina a chance to respond to your comments. Nina, what do you Jeannie, what do you say?
I say yes. I totally agree with that. And in fact, schools are regularly hearing complaints, handling complaints by male students about sexual misconduct. And sometimes there are complaints about sexual misconduct by other males. And increasingly, I would say in the last year, I myself have seen a number of complaints, the rise in complaints by males accusing other females of sexual misconduct. And I think that's a phenomenon that we're going to have to work hard to try to get our minds around, because as the caller suggests, we are in a pattern of talking about it as something that men, male students do to women students. And that is, of course, the majority of what we're going to continue to see for a while. But I think that the number of complaints by male students alleging misconduct by female students is rising, and it's going to actually cause some amount of, I think, reconsideration of what we consider sexual misconduct, because as the definitions of sexual misconduct have expanded so widely, in fact, many men can validly claim that they are assaulted by their female peers because the expansion of the definition makes it so that much of what's going on campus can be categorized as an assault.
I hear you. Nina, you want to add to that?
I just want to say I really appreciate the caller's point. Absolutely, this is not an issue only for women and girls. I was certainly talking about my experience in representing young women, but we also know that in addition to, of course, men and boys who are sexually assaulted, LGBT students face some of the highest rates of sexual assault and harassment. And so, we see these intersections play out in many different ways. We know that, you know, women and girls with disabilities have much higher rates of sexual assault and violence, and many women and girls of color as well. So it's a really important point.
Are you concerned, Nina, that if at least what DeVos has said, if that does become the standard, that it will prevent victims from coming forward? And I ask this, of course, knowing about the revelations about Harvey Weinstein's sexual harassment of women, especially in Hollywood, and that many of them did not come forward, including Ashley Judd, you know, until recently, of course, a pretty well-known actress. Are there lessons, you think, from what we're learning about Weinstein?
Well, I think in general, it's very hard for survivors to come forward. We know that sexual assault is a very underreported offense. We see in the work that we do, unfortunately, that in particular, girls of color that we've been representing recently are often blamed when they come forward. Instead of being helped, they are punished. So there was an example of a Latina in Michigan that we had spoken to recently who was raped by a football player in the parking lot. Mm. And when she went to the principal, he blamed her for being in the parking lot instead of being in the cafeteria where she was supposed to be at that time. She then suffered harassment both in school and on social media. And despite pleas for help from her mother, the school really did nothing, and she dropped out of school, had to finish her degree online, had depression, et cetera, and really has been trying to piece her life back together to go to college. So I think, you know, this is unfortunately a story that we hear over and over again, and it sends a real message to the rest of students, right? It creates a chilling effect when you see people being made to feel that they're at fault for being assaulted.
And I wonder from the other perspective, Jeannie, whether there have been male students, we'll keep this gender specific, but whether there have been male students falsely accused of some form of sexual assault.
Well, of course there have been male students and female students, all students, all kinds of students who've been falsely accused. But I think that it's a mistake to focus on false accusations as if that's what's driving, that's what should be driving our concerns about fair process. I do not think that the fair process concerns that I have expressed and that others of my colleagues who've been really concerned about it for years now, that's not about false accusations. It could be false accusations, but bottom line is, it's regardless of whether they're true or false, whether the stories are accurate, that it exists independently of the problem of unfair procedures that we see at a number of schools, and that the problem that Betsy DeVos is addressing, she's doing us a disservice, and she's making a mistake by focusing too much on the falsehood of the accusations that she is alleging, that there people are telling untrue stories. I think that regardless of whether it's true or false, you need a fair procedure to both sides. Both accusers and accused need to have a fair procedure for the entire system to be legitimate, for us to have trust in the outcomes and the accuracy of those outcomes, and to really believe that this is a worthwhile way to address sexual misconduct.
What would be a fairer system? And we're going to hold on to your phone line, but what would be a fairer system, Jeannie?
Well, in the problem with what has happened since 2011. Again, I do not think that the problem was caused by the 2011 Dear Colleague letter alone. I think it was the way that schools reacted to the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, in part in reaction to how the department was conducting itself around that letter. And so what a lot of schools did was kind of overreact to the 2011 Dear Colleague letter by doing a whole bunch of things that I consider extremely unfair. I'm sure Nina agrees in part with a lot of what I'm saying about how the schools just didn't have they maybe perhaps they didn't have adequate guidance, but whatever happened, they just decided that what the department wanted must be that they needed to privilege the accuser and treat the accused student unfairly. And so that is what happened at a lot of schools. Just really ridiculous things like students not even getting a copy of their of the accusation, of the complaint, not being entitled to bring lawyers to the hearing, not being able to have hearings, having cases resolved within, you know, maybe 2 days after the complaint was even filed without adequate investigation. And so there are many, many examples of this. None of this is in the Dear Colleague letter. None of the Dear Colleague letter doesn't say any of this. But the schools, it was just a rampant overreaction to what they did. And I think that what both Nina and I are concerned about is a possible rampant overreaction the other way, now that we have an administration who is saying that they want to address this. But overall, I think this is just so much beyond what the documents actually say. It's about how the schools are going to receive the message. And that is why I'm so adamant about making sure that people understand. Title IX has not been rescinded. Title IX enforcement has not been rescinded. And nothing about the structure of investigation and adjudication, the fact that those things are important to address sexual misconduct, none of that has been rescinded. What has been rescinded is a few points that the Dear Colleague letter of 2011 thought were important that are no longer considered to be the position of the department.
We're going to take, I know you want to say something, Nina. I just got to jump in here, and we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Hoping to get Jeannie Sook Gerson on a slightly better phone line. Joining us by phone, of course, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, contributing writer for The New Yorker, Nina Chowdhury, director of education, senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center. We are talking about the Department of Education's proposed changes on how colleges should handle sexual assault complaints, its effect it could have on victims and the accused. And you can join our conversation 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play one more clip from Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. She's speaking at George Mason University about a month ago, announcing changes to the processes schools and universities can use to investigate and prosecute cases of sexual assault.
One rape is one too many. One assault is one too many. One aggressive act of harassment is one too many. One person denied due process is one too many.
Nina, let me go back to you and picking up on what Jeannie said right before the break. Do you think colleges and universities, and that's who we're largely speaking about here, either misinterpreted what the Obama administration did or misunderstood or overreacted?
Well, I want to back up and say one thing first, which is that the increased enforcement that came from the Obama administration really had the result of many more survivors feeling comfortable coming forward. We saw a huge increase in complaints during the Obama administration's tenure at the Department of Education. And so I think that, you know, what we've always needed with Title IX, and this law has been around for 45 years. I've been working on the issue for 20, and we're still, you know, we have a long way to go on many fronts under Title IX, but what we need is greater enforcement. So, first of all, that had a big impact, and we've heard from many students about, you know, they're feeling more comfortable coming forward. I think that whatever schools may have interpreted or misinterpreted or done, again, there's no question that schools need help getting it right. I think, as Jeannie said, it wasn't the 2011 guidance or any other guidance that told them to do any of those things. So, first of all, the guidance actually provides more process and requires more fair process than even what, you know, is technically considered due process under the Constitution. So, unfortunately, I think by taking away that guidance and issuing this interim guidance that really tilts things the other, you know, in favor of accused students. It is causing a lot of confusion and uncertainty. Now we're waiting for some sort of notice and comment process. Again, there was already a comment process that they didn't even consider before they issued this new guidance. And I think it puts a lot of things, throws a lot of things into confusion. So we hope that schools continue to abide by the principles in the 2011 guidance. And again, they could have just worked with schools where there were particular problems to help them understand better what the guidance was. There was no need to issue new guidance. And I think, frankly, their credibility is really suspect, because when you have the head of the office that is charged with enforcing civil rights law say that, you know, 90% of the cases involve drunken, regretted sex, that casts real doubt on their ability to, one, understand this issue, to lead on this issue. And they have yet to come out and even affirmatively reject the rape myths that those comments help perpetuate.
Let me read an email from Peter picking up on that. He said, how many situations are truly we were both drunk? Yes, these situations do exist, but are they being given undue attention to the detriment of victims of rape? Jean, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, how much do we know how much alcohol plays a role or is part of the interaction here?
I think that all people who work on this issue know that there's a range of things that go under the heading of sexual assault. Some of them involve alcohol, some of them do not. Some of them involve both people being drunk, some of them involve one person being drunk and being taken advantage of, or I think there's a whole range of incidents. I think it's hard to know exactly what the number is in terms of the percentage that do involve alcohol. I think that everyone does understand that alcohol is sometimes involved, but I'm not sure what that's supposed to tell us, other than that alcohol is involved. I think that there's an implication in what Candace Jackson was saying, in that because alcohol is involved, that might mean that the incidents are not serious. If that's the implication, then mm-hmm. I reject that, and I think that we all should. I agree with Nina that that's something that is an unfortunate framing for this entire process, and I wish that weren't there.
Let me quote something you said, Jeannie, about Candace Jackson, a sexual assault survivor who supported the alleged victims of Bill Clinton and called alleged victims of Donald Trump fake victims. I don't want to politicize this, but I think we need to understand who this person is and perhaps her political perspective as the Education Department decides what this policy is going to be. Jeannie, you want to just respond to what you wrote there?
Well, I was just describing, I thought factually, what had happened, which was that she had said some victims were fake victims, namely the ones who were accusing the president that she supported, but she was obviously fully believing of the victims of Bill Clinton. I think that sometimes there is a political aspect of whether you choose to believe or not to believe. That does happen. Doesn't happen in every case, obviously, but in that case, it might be something to consider.
What do you think, Nina?
Well, I want to actually, you know, just point out, I mean, I agree with Jeannie that, you know, it is what it is. I don't necessarily want to get into the politics of it.
I understand.
I do think that one other thing that's important to note, and I think, you know, Jeannie mentioned something similar earlier, but, you know, the implications of her statements are that, as I see it, you know, that women are lying about rape or not credible. And I think it's important to note that the percentage of false reports, the data that we do have, I don't think we have a lot of data that would be helpful. But what we do know is the percentage of false reports of sexual assault range between 2-8%, which is no higher than false reports for any other crime. So I think, you know, that's an important statistic to know. And again, I also agree that, you know, unfortunately, Secretary DeVos's framing in her speeches and focus on false reports has really done a disservice here. Mm. I think also the fact that you know, she met with a number of groups the same day that I was at that session with her with survivors in the room. She met with groups who have a history of intimidating rape survivors and dismissing domestic abuse against women by saying it's their fault and they asked for it. So the kinds of people and groups that I think she met with on this issue also are really troubling because, again, I think we can have a real discussion about, you know, how should schools be ensuring that there's a fair process for both sides? I mean, I have a son. I clearly, you know, if this happened to him, I'd want a fair process for him just like I would for anybody and for all the students that we represent. So I think, but I think, unfortunately, that they have really damaged their own credibility and they lack credibility in this area.
And that's Nina Chowdhury. She's Director of Education and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Janisa Gerson joining us as well. She's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. And you can join our conversation giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499, especially if this issue is a personal one for you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let me just clear up some of my own confusion here, Jeannie, and I'll start with you. So currently, under Title IX, if I am being accused of a sexual assault, can I be informed of those charges? Do both sides have witnesses and evidence that can be introduced? And am I able to bring an attorney or some kind of an advocate to, if not represent me, at least be by my side if I am accused of a sexual assault?
So Title IX, of course, itself doesn't say anything about those issues. However, I think that if you look at the documents that have been issued by the department over the years, basic fairness would be a requirement, and I think all those things that you mentioned should be included in basic fairness. I think that you're going to see a lot of schools, like actually empirically, if you go and look at what a lot of schools are doing, they're going to have some of those elements missing, the ones that you mentioned and others. For example, at my own school, Harvard University, in 2014, when they put forward a policy that did not appear to allow attorneys to go with either the accused or the accuser into the interview, we, on the faculty, several of us, 28 of us, in fact, objected to that, and eventually the university did change its practice so that even though the policy doesn't seem to allow lawyers, in practice, lawyers are being permitted to go in with the parties that are being interviewed. So I think that it's really school by school how they're choosing to implement it. And I think I agree with Nina that more guidance could be a good thing. I don't think it was a bad thing to try to issue guidance without notice and comment. The main thing was the acting as if each element, namely, you know, the things that weren't actually binding were binding. So they acted as if it was law when it wasn't.
I mean, it seems like this is an argument, Nina, for consistency, so that depending on, you don't have different rules and regulations depending on where you're going to college.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, typically, just to step back again for 1 second, I mean, laws, when they're written, are not, you know, as detailed, right? So Title IX mm-hmm. is 37 words and talks broadly about, you know, not discriminating on the basis of sex. But then we have policies and guidance, as with any law, that sort of help put the meat on the bones and regulations. And so this 2011 guidance, first to answer your question, Marty, did talk about exactly the kinds of things you mentioned. It did say that you have to provide notice of the charges or, you know, the complaint, that the parties must have an equal opportunity to present relevant witnesses and evidence. I think that it didn't certainly require lawyers. I'm a lawyer. I don't know that that's always the best idea at every proceeding, but it did say that if a school allows an advisor or a lawyer or anybody to be present, that they have to do so equally for both parties. So it provided a framework, and I think, you know, it's tricky because Title IX has always, in many of its areas, been very flexible so that it's trying not to micromanage schools too much, right? It allows flexibility for them to do things as they see fit and a little bit differently. And sometimes if you get too specific, then you get pushback on the other end that you're really interfering in schools' processes. So, but it did provide and does provide the framework. I mean, the law is still in effect. And unfortunately, by taking away this guidance, you know, I think it's just thrown, as I said, a lot of things things into chaos for schools because they asked for this guidance to help them, and now it's been taken away, and this kind of interim, very not clear and somewhat contradictory, actually, to previous law guidance has been issued. So I think, again, you know, certainly more guidance, more technical assistance by the department would have been the better option here instead of trying to now tilt the scales in favor of accused students and making it harder for survivors.
Let me get Carol from Wilmington to join our conversation. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment that I appreciate the level of discourse that's going on around this subject matter. I may agree with one more than the other, but I appreciate the discourse. It's important around something this big that we had this conversation. And I think the most irresponsible thing that DeVos did, and I don't agree with the change, but it's the language in which she couched the change and just making it so that it is just un-American and it's this and the failure, and it could have been done in such a better way. And I think we need to use better language to help us to get to the point that we need to get to in conversations like this. And that's it.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Carol. Jeannie, do you agree?
I think that I would agree with a lot of what the caller said, and I think that surely if I am one who for years has been critical of the way that the Obama administration handled this issue in some of its details, not everything, and I've been a big critic of the way that schools have then handled this issue, in, namely in the issue of unfairness to the parties, and especially to accused students, when it comes to these adjudications. However, if I were writing a speech or guidance, I don't think that that is the framing that I would have chosen. I would have chosen the framing of, well, you know, everyone knows that this is what was done in 2011 had these intentions that we share, and now it's time, in any administration, that we're going to have some sort of a revision or some sort of refinement of what has happened, because sometimes things happen that you don't expect. Sometimes schools react in ways you don't expect. Sometimes you just have to revisit it after a few years to see whether things could be done better or given a little bit more meat on the bones, as Nina said, to make things clearer as to how they're supposed to happen. And I think that would have been a better framing. But, of course, this is a political world, and
yes,
everything is political. And so that's what we have. And my main fear is that as a result of all of this political posturing about the issue, that the message, the wrong message is going to be sent, which is that, it is no longer a world in which survivors can feel safe.
Nina, I'm giving you the last word, about a minute or so before I have to say goodbye. Either your hopes, your fears, or some combination of the two.
Well, just picking up quickly on what Jeannie said and the caller, I think the other thing that was really upsetting to me about DeVos's speech was that all the examples she used to justify a change were examples of where schools, if they were actually doing what she said, violated the current law. And so they were not justifications for changing the guidance. But my hope is that schools will not, follow the suggestions of this interim guidance, that they will continue to stand by their students, continue to assure students that sexual assault is something they take very seriously, and not change processes to make it harder for survivors to come forward, because I have seen firsthand the devastating impact that it has on students and their families, and we need to make sure that we keep our schools safe so that students can learn and stay in school.
We're going to end on that note. Nina Chowdhury, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you,
Nina. You're welcome.
Thank you.
And Jeannie Sook-Gerson, thank you for joining us as well. Jeannie, professor of law at Harvard Law School, contributing writer for The New Yorker. Nina is director of education and senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.